Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. It's been more than 50 years since civil rights leader Floyd McKissick announced an audacious plan to build a new city in rural North Carolina, open to all but intended primarily to benefit black people. Named Soul City, the community secured funding from the Nixon administration, planning help from Harvard and the University of North Carolina, and endorsements from the New York Times. McKissick's vision, built on a former slave plantation in Warren County, was projected to have 50,000 residents by the year 2000. Unfortunately, as Seton Hall law professor Thomas Healy explains in his new book, Soul City, Race, Equality, and the Lost Dream of an American Utopia, the utopian vision was not to be. Professor Healy recently joined us, along with former state senator Floyd McKissick Jr., the son of Soul City's founder, to discuss the dream, North Carolina politics, and some of the lessons the experiment holds for us today. Here's Professor Thomas Healy.
Great. Thank you so much, Rob. I appreciate that introduction. And thank you for setting this up. You know, as a native of North Carolina and as a former reporter at the News and Observer, it's a real pleasure to be able to talk about a story that is such an important part of North Carolina history and that has really, in my view, been overlooked and unfairly forgotten. To understand the vision behind Soul City, you have to understand that Soul City grew out of a much larger struggle. It grew out of the Black freedom struggle, and more specifically, it grew out of the civil rights movement, of which Floyd McKissick was a key leader. He was born in Asheville in 1922. He graduated from Morehouse and the law school at what is now North Carolina Central, and then integrated the law school at UNC and dedicated his professional life as a lawyer to the civil rights cause. He was heavily involved in representing the students who conducted the sit-ins in Greensboro, and he and other members of the Congress of Racial Equality really helped to spread the sit-in movement. As a leader of the civil rights movement, you know, he embraced the goals of the movement, and the goals of the movement shifted over the years, but they always included integration and expanding opportunities for African Americans and breaking down the barriers, both legal and social, that had been erected throughout our country's history. Like many people who were involved in the civil rights struggle, Floyd McKissick grew increasingly frustrated with the slow pace of change. Yes, laws were passed, and yes, progress was made. But as he and other leaders looked around, the lives of Black people had not changed significantly. They were still subject to discrimination in housing, still often faced barriers at the polls, and most prominently, in Floyd McKissick's view, they still lacked the kind of economic autonomy and equality that was really necessary to achieve political independence and political equality. And so he began to focus more and more on how do you create economic opportunity? How do you give African Americans control over their own economic destiny? And he had a lot of different ideas about how to achieve this. One of his ideas was that African Americans should build new cities, cities where they would have the majority share of power and capital, where they would not be at the mercy of other people. It was such an audacious idea that he had. And I think it was audacious because he realized that only if Black people could have power at the level of a city would they really have the kind of autonomy that they needed. And so that's what he decided to do. And he left his position as the head of the Congress of Racial Equality shortly after Martin Luther King was assassinated in the spring of 1968. And he embarked on his own, and he announced a plan to build Soul City in Warren County, an hour north of Raleigh-Durham. He initially purchased a plot of about 1,800 acres, but identified adjacent land amounting to about 5,000 acres that he decided he would use to build Soul City. And so he announced this plan in January of 1969, and he set out on a process of trying to plan and develop a city that he hoped would have 50,000 residents by the year 2000. Floyd McKissick wasn't the only person who was interested in building new cities at this time in our history, because the late 1960s were a time of great turmoil and unrest in cities around the country. There were problems with housing, there were problems with unemployment, there were problems with crime in a lot of the great cities in the country. And there was this prediction that there was going to be this huge population growth in the last few decades of the century, and that the way to deal with this would be to build new communities around the country, new growth centers that could absorb the population growth, take some of the pressures off of the big cities in the north and in the west, and sort of start from scratch and avoid some of the problems that the cities were then facing. And Congress allocated $500 million to build new cities around the country. The Department of Housing and Urban Development, which was new at the time, was charged with overseeing this program, with identifying the developers that were serious and that had feasible plans, and then providing funding and working with the developers to build these cities. And that was the program that Soul City ultimately ended up being a part of. One of the remarkable things about this story is how much support Floyd McKissick was able to generate in a relatively short period of time. I mean, he went from announcing this out of the blue in January 1969, with everybody sort of saying, what are you talking about? And people being skeptical, to within 3 years, he had the support of all of the local officials in Warren County and in nearby counties. He had the support of the state bureaucracy, both Bob Scott, who was governor from 68 to 72, and Jim Holzhauser, who was governor from 72 to 76, supported Soul City and were behind Soul City. He had the support of pretty much the entire University of North Carolina. He had the support of the Washington establishment. He switched political parties, became a Republican in 1972, and had the support of the Nixon administration, and had a lot of initial enthusiasm from corporations around the country. And it really just shows you sort of how serious he took the planning of Soul City, what an amazing salesman he was in being able to generate this kind of support, and not just salesman in the sense of, you know, slick salesman. He really was able to show people how building a new city in that part of the state, halfway between Richmond and Raleigh-Durham, in a very economically depressed part of the state, how that would benefit the state as a whole, how it would benefit lots of people in that area, not only the Black population, which was two-thirds of the county, but also the white population. And I think that's one of the more hopeful and inspiring parts of the story, is his ability to show people in the state and outside of the state the value of a project like this.
Coming up next, we'll hear more from our conversation with Professor Thomas Healy and Floyd McKissick Jr. as they discuss why Soul City and the dream of this American utopia ultimately didn't succeed. Stay with us.
Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. In 1969, with America's cities in turmoil and racial tensions high, civil rights leader Floyd McKissick announced he would build a new city in rural North Carolina named Soul City. Author Thomas Healy resurrects this forgotten saga of race, capitalism, and the struggle for equality in his new book, and we resume our conversation with Professor Healy about the improbable odds this utopian vision in North Carolina faced.
In the coverage of the book, that's one of the things that a lot of people have remarked upon, how close he actually came to making this happen in a very short period of time. I mean, between the time that he actually received federal money in the spring of 1974 and the time the federal government basically said it would no longer support Soul City in 1979, that's five short years that elapsed during which the kind of real physical development of Soul City was taking place. So all of which begs the question, well, why didn't it succeed? The general challenge of trying to build a new community like this from scratch. And you know, that cannot be underestimated, just how difficult it was to try to attract industry to provide jobs at the same time that you attract residents who can work those jobs, and at the same time that you build all of this infrastructure. It was a daunting challenge. As I say in the book, it was not impossible, but it was improbable, right? Everything would have had to go correctly. The economy in the 1970s was not favorable. We had two recessions, a combination of high inflation and low growth, which made any kind of large-scale real estate development like this incredibly difficult. And then there were the political forces that were arrayed against Soul City. And to me, those political forces were the biggest obstacles in the way of Soul City, because had there been support from sort of all all parts of the political establishment, he might have been able to overcome the economic headwinds that he faced. But he did have political obstacles, and they took two forms. One was Jesse Helms. Jesse Helms was elected to the Senate in 1972, and he made clear from the outset that he was opposed to Soul City and that he would do everything in his power to stop it. He sent Floyd McKissick a letter right after he was elected, after McKissick reached out to him to extend an olive branch. And Jesse Helms said, I'm not interested. I'm going to, at the first opportunity, I'm going to launch a federal investigation into how you're spending money at Soul City. He had not even been to Soul City, but he was just instinctually opposed to it because he was pretty much instinctually opposed to anything that would advance the interests of Black people. But that's part of the story. And that, to my mind, that's the kind of the obvious, predictable part of the story. The less predictable part of the story, and from my perspective, the sort of the more confounding and intriguing part, was the opposition that McKissick faced from the left, from the liberal side of the political aisle. And this really took the form of Claude Sitton and the Raleigh News and Observer, Claude Sitton, who was the editor of the News and Observer, and who was revered within civil rights circles for his coverage of the movement. When he was a reporter for the New York Times, he was equally opposed to Soul City because he believed, or at least expressed the belief, that this was a step backwards from integration. Although McKissick made clear from the beginning that Soul City would be integrated, that it would be a multicultural city, Claude Sitton could only really understand this as a separatist venture. And as he put it, he thought it reeked of defeatism and withdrawal. He compared it to sociological sport. The News and Observer was really opposed to Soul City from the beginning. And that manifested itself in a series of articles that were published in 1975, alleging all sorts of fraud and corruption and mismanagement, that allowed Jesse Helms to call for that federal audit that he had wanted to call for from the beginning, an audit that ultimately largely cleared McKissick of any charges of wrongdoing, but that cast a huge shadow over Soul City that McKissick was never really able to overcome. The federal government ultimately said, look, we don't believe in Soul City anymore. And it refused to provide any additional funding, which meant that no industry was going to come to Soul City. And so, you know, I'll just end by saying that if we want to kind of take a lesson away from Soul City, to my mind, the lesson is a lesson about how people who express a belief in racial equality and who, you know, who think that they're on the side of racial justice need to have some, and I'm really talking here about white people, like Claude Sitton, need to have some humility about their own wisdom and need to listen more closely to what people like Floyd McKissick are saying needs to be done in order to achieve economic equality. Because in my mind, that's what did not happen here. Someone like Claude Sitton, you know, who I think did believe in racial equality, but was really only able to imagine that equality sort of taking one form. And that was the sort of traditional form of Black Americans integrating and assimilating into white society, rather than Black Americans having spaces of their own that were sort of culturally Black and predominantly Black, sort of just based on numbers, but that were equally integrated. And I think too many people in positions of power could not get their heads around that vision of integration. And to me, that's one of the big tragedies of Soul City and one of the big lessons that we can learn from Soul City. I'll wrap up my comments and pass it on to Senator McKissick.
No one alive today has a more intimate recollection of the details of the Soul City experiment than Floyd McKissick Jr., son of the late civil rights activist and Soul City founder Floyd McKissick. Listeners, of course, may recognize the younger McKissick as a former state senator from Durham and current member of the North Carolina Utilities Commission. During our conversation, he recalled his father's dream as a business venture that attracted some of the best and brightest minds who saw real promise in building a multiracial city.
We wanted to provide opportunities for people to have jobs and positions of influence and positions of control and all the aspects of developing a project like Soul City and its inherent complexity, and provide those jobs to people who might not have had the opportunity to do it otherwise. We were multiracial. About a third of our workforce was white, but we also had talented people like Harvey Gantt, who had gotten out of MIT, who was ultimately became the first African-American mayor of Charlotte, who was the first planner who worked for us in terms of conceiving of some of the initial land development plans. People like Eva Clayton, who later became the first African-American female who won a seat in Congress, who was there assisting us through the Soul City Foundation and doing social planning. We were about bringing about fundamental change, substantial change, significant change, and doing it in a multiracial concept. Now, I think some people got caught up with the idea of the name Soul City. And to be candid with you, I attribute that to what we might call today implicit bias, unconscious bias, not even realizing that they were opposed to it because of its name. But I can recall living in that era, and I say, well, you know, hey, I'm spending time over Worcester, Massachusetts. It'd be a place called White City East. I'd say somebody, you think only white people can live there? They said, no, that's ridiculous. And I'd ask people here in North Carolina, you know, there's a city called Whiteville. You think only white people can live there? No, that's insane. Well, why do they think only Black people can live in Soul City? It was their implicit bias that they weren't aware of that in some instances caused them to take a step back and not understand and appreciate that there could be a community that was a mixed race community that provide open opportunity and access for whites as well as Black to hold leadership positions. And many whites held leadership positions within the Soul City company and the development team. And we worked as co-equals with mutual respect, knowing what our goals and our objectives were and our strategic plans for doing so. You know, the 70s kind of burst the bubble. But it was a great site. I mean, I think even today it remains a great site. I mean, I was reading recently about the infrastructure bill that's being proposed by President Biden and what they want to do in North Carolina in terms of extending rail up to Richland. That would go right past Soul City. They're talking about a stop up in Henderson. Henderson's like 15 miles from Soul City. In fact, there was a stop for rail in Henderson during the time frame that we were developing for Amtrak in that time frame. And we actually built a major siding off of the track to provide access to our industrial park, you know, because it needed rail access. So, I mean, hey, it still possesses the attributes. It just takes a concerted effort to think about how it can be utilized today.
The book is Soul City, Race, Equality, and the Lost Dream of an American Utopia. We've been delighted to be joined by the author, Seton Hall Law Professor Thomas Healy, and Floyd McKissick Jr., the son of Soul City's founder.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, that's it for this edition of News and Views. Remember, you can check us out online and subscribe for free to some of our state's best news coverage and political commentary at ncpolicywatch.com. For producer Clayton Henkel, it's Rob Schofield. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to News and Views. A weekly look at state and policy issues is a production of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com.